My name is Tia Foster. I am originally from Ohio, moved to New York City 4 years ago, and then recently moved upstate. I started my activism doing animal rights and then got into environmentalism and then human rights. I'm a recovering bleeding heart liberal. I think some of my beliefs actually always matched the new right, but I didn't know a new right existed when I was growing up in a small town of Ashland, Ohio. My experience of right wing, when someone said, what is right wing? I would say, well, it's like Jerry Falwell or George W. Bush. That was my only experience, and I was really turned off by that. And so I made liberal activist friends and started working with them and just brainwashed myself into believing this was correct. And I was very politically correct, followed the whole notion of white guilt and all that, and really didn't know that anything else existed until recently. Now I'm learning. So that's my story.
Well, you had been an activist with Occupy Wall Street, and I know from our prior conversations you've told me about some of your interesting experiences there. Why don't you let our audience in on that?
Well, when Occupy Wall Street started, I was very excited. I had been doing activism for so long that I felt like I hadn't been making a difference. When you first start doing activism, it's really exciting, and you think you're going to change the world. And then after the years go by, you realize you're really not changing much of anything. And it sort of becomes like a subculture, and you know, some people are just in it to make friends or whatever, be accepted. And so when Occupy Wall Street started, I thought it was going to be like an Arab Spring. That's what everyone was comparing it to. So I got in there from the beginning. And the first couple weeks, it was amazing. It was really exciting to see so many people come together. And, you know, we set up sort of like a little community there. We were all sleeping there. You know, we would feed each other. We had comfort stations set up. We give out blankets. We had a medical station set up. And it just seemed really great. But things started to change very quickly. I came there with my own agenda, I'll admit. I wanted to spread the message of animal liberation and talk about environmentalism, two things that I'm really interested in that are really dear to my heart. And so I set up the animal rights group of Occupy Wall Street. And I was also heavily involved with the environmental solidarity group of Occupy Wall Street. And when I first started noticing that things were screwed up was I had put together this group and I had decided we were going to do like a day of teach-ins and seminars with various guests speaking on animal rights. They were doing the same thing in the environmental solidarity group. In both groups, I was criticized in the animal rights group, and then the organizer of the environmental solidarity group was criticized too, because we didn't have enough people of color on the panel. Mind you, I had about a week to plan this. I reached out to different universities, different public speakers, anyone I could get. And it just happened to be that the people I got were white. This wasn't my fault. I'm interested in anything anyone has to say about animal rights, no matter what color, religion, gender, sexuality they are. I could care less. But we spent the entire meeting, people attacking me, saying, look how this is going to look. You know, you don't have any people of color. This is talking about white privilege and how no one's going to listen to us and how we have to reach out. And I said, you're making race an issue when it clearly isn't an issue. This is about, you know, the 59 billion animals a year killed for food, hundreds of thousands of animals killed in the fur trade, animals in testing laboratories. This is not about the color of the person's skin. That's when I first started noticing something was wrong. And then during General Assembly, they set it up so if you were a woman of color, you got to speak first. If you were a man of color, you got to speak second. If you were a white female, you got to speak third. If you were a white male, you got to speak fourth. And I didn't understand that. If you want everyone to be equal, then why are you giving special privileges? And my experience started changing. And I started seeing these were a lot of disillusioned liberals oozing with white guilt that really didn't know what they were talking about and that didn't even really necessarily want equality. They just wanted to give special privileges to different groups. And I thought that was wrong.
Okay, well, you've had some subsequent run-ins with the politically correct crowd. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your experiences at the hands of the Zionists?
Oh, God. it's difficult for me to talk to even now because there's a lot of emotions. They really hurt me and they upset me. I've been doing activism for so long. I've been doing direct rescue of animals, and I was always been there to help someone if they needed it. Always been there to help an animal. Where I think a lot of animal rights activists, they just enjoy going and standing with a sign and being provocative. And so, you know, I consider myself a good friend of these people. I consider myself a good activist. And this was right after Occupy Wall Street, after I pretty much washed my hands of that. This is really what the final straw was. I had seen this video on YouTube called The Hola Hoax by a Jewish man named David Cole. And it was interesting. He went to Auschwitz and he found inconsistencies with the theory of the gas chambers. And he wasn't saying that, he wasn't a neo-Nazi, obviously, as a Jewish man, but he was saying that maybe history didn't happen exactly how we think it happened. Maybe 6 million people didn't die. Maybe they didn't die in the ways that, you know, our school books have told us they've died in all these movies and Schindler's List. Maybe that's incorrect. And I wasn't even necessarily agreeing with him. I just thought, this is interesting. Maybe we need to take a closer look at what happened. So I posted the video. And I had no idea the backlash I was about to receive. I had every Jewish activist and a lot of white activists call me racist, tear me down for that video, demand I take it off right away. And I said, no, this is my freedom of speech. You liberals are angry because of the police, how they tried to silence us during protests, about how people tried to censor us. But yet you're doing the exact same thing to me. So instead of taking that down, I posted about 10 more videos, videos by David Irving, videos by Ernst Zundel. And I started researching and finding out that it's illegal in so many different countries to even question the Holocaust. And I said, okay, now you guys have forced me to really get into this. Now I want to learn more. And they took it a step farther. They sent out mass messages to people, telling them not to work with me, telling them not to attend my animal rescue events, telling them not to attend my protests. Some sent me death threats. And the worst thing that they did was I was doing an animal adoption event. And about 20 of them showed up with signs saying I was a neo-Nazi, surrounded my table with these abandoned kitties and puppies who were trying to adopt out, just find good homes for them, and started protesting me. And I thought, do these people even realize they're not just hurting me, they're hurting these animals? There were also a lot of rumors spreading going on, some of which was, like, laughable, saying that they saw me in pornographic films having sex with a German Shepherd dog, saying that I actually torture and hurt animals, all kinds of really sick, bizarre rumors. And this really, it got me more into studying the very issues that they didn't want me to bring up. And it created a lot of tension, a lot of anger. And I felt like they complain about anti-Semitism, but they're creating it by doing these things. Not that I think every Jewish person is like that, but it definitely affected me and my outlook on things.
You mentioned your interest in animal welfare and in ecology. There's a common perception that movements like animal rights or ecology are essentially leftist, you know, far left movements. They're thought of as more or less being part of the domain of the left. But you've mentioned before that there's really no reason why it needs to be that way, that there's really no reason why people, say, from the right shouldn't be interested in ecology or animal welfare. Do you want to speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, I do. Something I think I told you was animals cannot pick a political side. There's no such thing as a cow with issues, with opinions or issues on gay marriage. You know, there's no such thing as a right-wing pig or a left-wing chicken. These are innocent creatures that can't pick a political side. So the protection of them, I don't think, should be associated with left or right. It should be part of being a decent human being. You go to any factory farm, you see the way that these animals are treated. These creatures that have minds that function very well, that feel pain just like we do. And I really don't see why that has to be equated with left or right. As far as environmental stuff, don't we all want clean air to breathe? Don't we all want clean water to drink? You know, why do you have to be a liberal to want to drink clean water? And something I've noticed, though, the best way to be taken as a joke is say you're into animal rights, because even though the majority of animal rights activists are liberals, the majority of liberals are not animal rights activists. So both the right and the left tend to take you not very seriously. And what bothers me is animal rights is oftentimes taken, it's written off as an issue like gay marriage or abortion, and I don't think that that's fair. This is real suffering going on, and the mass farming of animals affects us. It contaminates our water. It pollutes our air. So we suffer as a result of it. I think it's the way of a moral human being to care about the environment and to care about animals. And some of the old right-wing thinkers, I'm not part of the old right, but you look at Savitri Devi or Martin Heidegger, they were very much for the protection of natural resources and species. So I don't think it should be considered a left or right issue, no.
All right. Well, you've also mentioned that along the way you've developed an interest in the philosophy of national anarchism. Tell us a little bit about how you discovered that and came to be interested in national anarchism.
To be honest, Keith, I don't know enough about it yet to say that I'm a national anarchist, but I like the idea of autonomous communities instead of one central government. I lived for a while by the Amish when I was in Ohio, and I actually liked them. They were good people. And I saw that the way they lived was sort of like a tribe community. You know, they don't pay taxes. They're not drafted. They refuse to be drafted. They only send their children up to the eighth grade. They follow their own set of rules based on their culture, based on their tradition, and based on their religion. But I don't think that these tribes or communities have to be religious. I think we should be able to pick and choose how we want to live our life, join a community based on our traditions, our values. And if we don't want to be in that community, we're free to leave and join another one. I like that idea, and I think that that's more of how ancient people lived. This idea that we have to follow these rules that, you know, that these people in power make up for us, that mandate whether or not we accept gays, whether or not women have certain rights, statutory rape laws, all these things, that's not necessarily my values, that's not necessarily my neighbor's values, so why do we have to follow them? I feel like this, we should be able to do what we want as long as we're not infringing on the rights of another. And going back to animal rights, I question whether mass farming of animals or wearing fur, if that's really a personal right, since I think it does take away the right of another, the right of animals. That's how I originally got into national anarchy. I did experience a little bit of, I don't like to use the word racist lightly, but I did experience a little bit of racism when I started going to the message boards for national anarchy. Some people making fun of me because I'm half Iranian. But, you know, I don't really care. I think that people have a right to be racist if they want to be. That doesn't mean I want to be around them. So I was a little put off by it at first, but now it doesn't really bother me, and I know a lot of national anarchists that aren't.
Well, you've discussed some of your own experiences with multiculturalism, and you mentioned that because of that, you've developed a somewhat skeptical view of multiculturalism. Do you care to discuss any of that?
Yeah, I do. It's been an issue all my life that I've dealt with. My mother is a dark-skinned Iranian woman who left Iran during the late 70s, during the revolution. Her father was minister of education under the Shah, and they're very traditional family. And then she married my father, who is of Serbian descent, but very Americanized, and grew up in a small town where I was born with white skin, but very Middle Eastern features. So never really knowing quite where to belong, not knowing to call yourself white, not knowing to call yourself, you know, Middle Eastern, being teased by family members on your Middle Eastern side saying that you're a half-breed, but not being accepted by the people in your town because you're different. So I think that if people want to intermarry, marry different races, I think that's fine as long as they realize there are consequences. I think that we all like that feeling of belonging and wanting a people to go to. And I never really felt like I had that. So it's still first world problems. You know, I can't compare it to what's going on in other countries to children. But, you know, it's worth taking a look at. It's worth considering before you enter into that union and have children, I think. And I don't think we should force multiculturalism on anyone. People have a right to preserve their culture. People have a right to preserve their traditions and their race, and no one should force them not to.
Well, during your time as an activist, you've mentioned that you already also had some encounters with feminism that were interesting, to say the least. What have been your experiences with feminists during your time on the far left?
Very, very unpleasant women. Some of the times I felt most judged and oppressed haven't been around men, although that's happened, of course, but most of the time it's been around radical feminists. I don't define myself as a feminist anymore because I feel like how feminism is being defined in these times, that just doesn't fit what I am. I believe that women should have choices. I don't want to be mistreated because I'm a woman, but I don't believe I'm better than anyone, and I don't believe men are evil, any more evil than women are. But my experience with the feminists at Occupy Wall Street especially, you know, as soon as I walked over to the feminist working group, I got dirty looks. They kind of looked at each other and snickered almost. And, you know, because I wear makeup and I'm, you know, I'm feminine. I look feminine. And so they judged me right away on my looks. And then when I opened my mouth, started talking, I defended sex workers. I defend, you know, women. If women want to be in porn, I think that's fine. That's their choice. If women want to be prostitutes, that's fine. And the women attacked me for that. And I said, well, isn't feminism about making choices? And one woman actually said, no, feminism is not about making choices. Feminism is about overthrowing the oppressive patriarchy and replacing it with strong, intelligent women who can make good choices for all women. And I was confounded by that. I couldn't believe that. And I said, well, you don't think people should make their own choices? She said, no, because there's a lot of women that will make the wrong choice. I said, well, what's wrong for you may not be wrong for me. If a woman wants to be a housewife and stay at home and have her man take care of her, I think that's fine. I choose not to do it, but why should I look down on her for doing it? So that was my experience with feminists.
You've certainly had a lot of interesting experiences with the left. I'm going to take a little bit of a break now, and we'll return in a few with our and continue our interview with Tia Foster. Welcome back to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, here at Counter Currents. I'm speaking with Tia Foster. Tia is certainly a very interesting person whom I met recently, who's been involved for some time with activism from the radical left and has talked a little bit about her experiences being persecuted by the Zionists, some of her encounters with some of the more crazy aspects of PC at Occupy Wall Street, her interest in animal welfare. Looking over some of your information on Facebook, Tia, I see that you're also interested in mysticism things like that. Do you want to delve into that a little bit? And one thing that a lot of people on the alternative right are interested in is what might be called alternative religions. There are some people who are not adherents of the, you know, traditional Christian paradigm of the mainstream society, who are interested in either neo-paganism or the occult or other religions that are not thought of as being traditional in mainstream middle American society. So what is the source of some of your interest in that, and what are some of your ideas along those lines?
Well, I'm definitely not part of any religion, but I used to call myself an atheist, and I had a big turning point. it's going to sound silly, but I did a drug called DMT, or some people call it ayahuasca. Are you familiar with it?
I am, yes.
Okay. You know, when people told me about DMT, I laughed at them because I thought I knew everything there was to know about acid, mushrooms, psychedelics. I thought it's just another drug. Sorry, my dog is barking. I thought it was just another drug. I thought, this is, so what? Why are you people, what's the big fuss about it? And then I did it. And I saw things I can't explain. I experienced things I can't explain. And I really believe that there is more to it than just your subconscious mind. Because what I saw under DMT, these are things that don't exist in this universe. It's hard to explain. I saw colors that don't exist in this world. I saw weird shapes, patterns, creatures that I'm convinced weren't just my mind playing tricks on me. And I started, you know, researching different ancient religions and beliefs, and a lot of the stuff that I see in like old paintings, like Mayan paintings, were similar to what I saw in DMT. And I am interested in the occult, but I can't ascribe to any one belief system because in the end, I just don't know. But I think that we all want a sense of where we came from. And so that sparked my interest. I'm also really interested in like ancient Persian religions, Zoroastrianism, Mithra, Manichaeism. Just because that's where my people come from, I want to know more about it.
Well, how would you contrast the difference between mysticism and religion?
Religion, there's more absolutes. There's sets of rules that go along with it. And I think with mysticism, there really aren't many rules. With spirituality, you know, and I don't like these corny New Age people that, you know, they spend $1,000 to go on a retreat to try to find peace or whatever. I think that's silly. But I think that there are other forces, other dimensions. And with mysticism, I think it's just seeking. With religion, you believe you've already found it. And I don't think with mysticism, it actually offers any complete answers. It just gives you glimpses, I think. Religion is more of a story of submission. If you look at just Judeo-Christian religion, the story of Adam and Eve, for instance, that's a total story of submission. They ate from the tree of knowledge and they're exiled. It's basically telling you not to seek, not to learn, not to know too much, where mysticism, I think, encourages thought. But, you know, right now, recently, I haven't been doing too much researching of mysticism lately. It's always going to be an interest of mine. But recently, I've just been doing my animal adoption events and concentrating on everyday life. But it still sparks my interest.
Well, I know that another thing that you're interested in, and this is something that's obviously going to be very controversial, is you're interested in some of the ideas associated with a fellow named Charles Manson. Tell us a little bit about that.
Okay, there's a lot of misconception about Charles Manson. I've been interested in Charles Manson for a long time. I remember growing up and hearing what everybody else heard on the media about he was evil, he's a mass murderer, which that title, that doesn't make any sense. He never killed anybody that we know of. Certainly, he wasn't guilty of the crimes he was convicted of, I don't think. And so I started researching the case, and what really stood out to me was that the prosecutor, Bugliosi, said he could not represent himself in court because he felt like he would be too convincing. Isn't that the point of lawyers? They're supposed to convince people? And a lot of the things he says, he comes off as crazy because he speaks in riddles, he speaks in metaphors, he's very animated, so people think he's crazy. But if you really listen to what he's saying, he's right. And what really, really sparked my interest in him was his views on the environment and his views on animals. He's a vegetarian. He coined a term called ATWA, air, tree, water, animals. He believes there's no compromise when it comes to defending our earth. And, you know, he grew up a redneck from the rolling hills of Kentucky. He's not some, you know, privileged liberal. He grew up poor, but he believes that we need to protect our resources. He's very critical of the current system. Recently did an interview where he's criticizing Obama. And he still has followers today. Also, I don't believe that he was guilty of the murders he committed. If you look at the case, it was there was a man named Bobby Beausoleil who killed a man named Gary Hinman. And to try to make it look like Black Panthers did it, he wanted to frame Black Panthers for it. He wrote on the wall, political piggy. This wasn't Charles Manson that did that. There was no race war or anything like that. He just wanted to blame someone else for the murder. Bobby Beausoleil went to prison. Susan Atkins and her friends wanted to blame someone else for doing that. They wanted to make it look like Bobby Beausoleil was framed. So they went out and they committed these murders and wrote the same thing on the wall to make it seem like the murderers were still out there. That's what I believe happened. I think the whole race war thing was just to get public hatred against him, just to make him look bad. I think that Bugliosi made that up.
Well, Bobby Beausoleil has actually recorded a lot of music since his time in prison, and some of that's actually available online. He mm-hmm. is actually a very talented musician and songwriter and composer. Mm-hmm. And a lot of Charles Manson's music is now available. I actually enjoy listening to a lot of Manson's music. I think it's a lot of the songs are really interesting. You know, I wouldn't consider myself a fan of his or anything like that, but his music is quite interesting, I do think. Based on your experiences with the radical left at Occupy Wall Street, with the feminists and so forth, do you see the left really being a movement that has any real chance to bring about any real change in our society or be any kind of effective oppositional force to the establishment?
Oh, hell no. They're so fractured and they all hate each other. They're completely disorganized. And, you know, my experience of them was they spent more time arguing about rhetoric and about, you know, how to include more Black people than they did about actually doing anything. They waste time. They sit on their ass and they talk. And, you know, I'm not an intellectual, Keith. I haven't read all the books you have, or probably many of your listeners have, or studied a lot of what you have, but I was sitting there in the middle of them hearing them talk, and they didn't get anything done. And where is Occupy Wall Street now? You know, just random people posting things on Facebook. I mean, where's the movement now? What are they going to do? And I supported a lot of the central messages. You know, I definitely support the fact that our current system is oozing with corruption and criminality. And I think that the right and left both had that in common. But the left just sat around and wanted to argue and bicker, and they're worried about all these pet issues like gay marriage. And I don't care if two queers want to get married. I don't think that we should spend all our time working on that. I think that Obama supporters, they voted for him because they thought he was cool, because he was pro-abortion. You know, they ignored what he had to say about free trade. They ignored the fact he's sending more troops into Iraq. What about that? They ignored big issues. And I think that the majority of the liberals, the majority of the left, they're not very deep. And they just focus on surface issues. And how are you going to change the world with, you know, gay marriage? That's not going to stop war. That's not going to fix the economy. It seems to be all they're talking about, though. But no, I don't think they're going to change anything.
Well, you mentioned that how the left, the different factions of the left, hate each other. I'm always interested in hearing stories about that, because a major part of my thinking is that I think that what is going to bring the liberal establishment down eventually is when all these cracks in what I call the PC coalition start to emerge and become more pronounced, when all the different political interest groups that make up the left start turning on each other. What examples of that have you seen in your own experiences as an activist?
Of infighting in
yes.
the community, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness.
And war, just general war, warfare, conflict between the different factions of the left.
Can I give you an example of animal rights activists fighting? I mean, since they're considered
sure.
left-wing. I'll say how our own movement's never going to get ahead if we don't get it together. You know, animal rights activists tend to be have some of the biggest egos. And we were constantly fighting. It's always these battles between, you know, well, this group believes, PETA, for instance. You have these activists who hate PETA. You have PETA always hating other activists. They're against, you know, they're on their, they're kind of like, they make fools out of all of us. But there's this guy named Nathan Winograd who is trying to reform shelters and doesn't want to kill pets in shelters. And, you know, PETA goes on their website and gossips about him and talks horribly about him just because they don't agree. They had a falling out with him. And he criticizes them for killing a lot of dogs that they don't even try to get adopted out. And they're spending all this time arguing back and forth and maligning each other. This is just an example. And all the while, look how many animals are dying and hurting, and they're not even spending their time doing this. Their infighting, I think, is what tears down every movement. Within the feminist movement, you have the pro-sex feminists, and then you have these radical feminists, and they both hate each other. And it's just women hating other women. How is that feminism? They're not getting ahead. And, you know, during Occupy Wall Street, I felt like the left should have joined forces with other, you know, right-wing anti-statist groups, but they wouldn't. There's always fighting between them. There's always, like when a few of us, you know, we got upset when we were having people like Russell Simmons and Kanye West come in and we were embracing them. And other activists thought, no, this would be great. This is great. It's getting publicity of the movement. No one could agree on, you know, who to represent us, what to do. A very fractured group.
Well, you mentioned some of your encounters with communists as well. You know, a lot of people probably view the communist as an anachronistic movement. But some of these little, I've always called them the commie cults, some of those groups are still around. What was your experience with those?
We had so many communists come to Occupy Wall Street. They handed out their little journal. And some of them came to our animal rights meetings. And I said, how can you be a communist and be an animal rights activist? Communism is based on the exploitation of, it's industrialization. It's based on the exploitation of natural resources and animals. It's about putting humans and their petty, any kind of petty human interests far above the environment, far above animals. And most of them, they really were not very deep people. When I actually started talking to the majority of these communists, they hadn't even read, about Karl Marx. They didn't even know what he stood for. I think it just sounded cool and subversive to say you're a communist. Because they've been so oppressed in the past and hated by in different countries, it became cool now to say you're a communist. I think a lot of these white kids growing up middle-class homes or upper-class homes, it's like they wanted to be an oppressed group. They wanted to join anything that was oppressed because they thought it was cool. You know, like, well, I'm not black, I'm not Hispanic, I'm not gay, but I'm a communist. And then, you know, then they could claim, I don't know, they could claim something. They thought that was cool. So I didn't really take them very seriously.
Well, one thing I find interesting is that among a lot of more countercultural young people on the left now, there's Che Guevara has become something of an icon, which is...
I hate him.
What's funny is that you see these kids with these Che Guevara t-shirts on. And, and in real life, the real Che Guevara, you know, did everything he could to repress the counterculture in Cuba. I mean, if you were, you know, a hippie or something like that in the 60s in Cuba, they rounded you up off the street and threw you in prison. So it's, you know, it's a really...
He hated homosexuals, too. I'd see gay guys wearing his shirts. I said, what are you doing? Che Guevara was, you know, machismo. He did not like homosexuals. Animal rights activists with Che Guevara shirts. I said, you know, he was a doctor. You know, during his college years, he vivisected many animals. Did you know that? Do you care? He was very oppressive. He was not a nice person. He was brutal. He took pleasure in killing people. And they're walking around with these Che Guevara shirts, and they don't even know what they stand for. You might as well take a Saddam Hussein shirt and wear it around. I mean, what's the difference? Come on. And, you know, the same people that support people like Che Guevara or Obama, anyone who would question, like, parts of national, which I'm not a national socialist, I'm very critical of Nazism and neo-Nazis, but I'll listen to what they have to say, but these same people would absolutely not listen to anything they'd have to say, but yet praise people like Che Guevara, who was also a killer, who was also oppressive, praise people like Obama, who is an imperialist, who's oppressive, who's sending more troops over, who's been sending more troops over to the Middle East. You know, you pick and choose what you want to hear, what they want to believe. I feel like sometimes the left, they just read off a script. And a lot of them are pseudo-intellectuals that just, like, they'll read a pamphlet or they'll look up something on Wikipedia, and it's like they're reciting something, but they don't really understand it. I'm more of, I guess, common sense. I'm not intellectual. I don't pretend to be, but I'm open to learning new things. I think I've learned, though, enough about the left.
On one of my broadcasts on Voice of Reason, I remember interviewing Velf Herferth, who's a veteran nationalist activist going back more than 30 years. And he was talking about his experiences and his encounters with the left, saying that the left seemed to be more like a sect than anything else. He compared them to the Church of Scientology in the sense that they're, you know, it's a movement of people that just seem brainwashed by a lot of ideas that really make no sense and don't fit with each other and all that. Okay, well, we're at the end of our second segment. I'll return in a few minutes and continue with the final part of our interview with Tia Foster. Tune in. Welcome back to Attack the System. I'm your host, Keith Preston, on Countercurrents. I'm here with Tia Foster. We're continuing our interview. And I know in our past conversations, Tia, we've talked about some of the really comical groups that we've encountered on the left. And while this necessarily isn't a serious issue, it's not a serious philosophical question that's involved. But, you know, I know from my own experiences, having been an activist on the radical left back in the 1980s and early 1990s, you know, a lot of my associates from Attack the System were involved in Occupy Wall Street in various capacities. And I hear story after story after story from, you know, political acquaintances and associates that participated in Occupy Wall Street about all the crazy political groups, about all the strange and twisted causes they were trying to promote. I know one fellow who said he was coming across groups with titles like, you know, the Fat Chicks Caucus and things like that. The funny thing about it is that I first encountered that kind of stuff myself during my time on the left in the 80s. I was I did not grow up in a leftist environment at all. I came from the Christian fundamentalist subculture, a fairly radical version of that. You know, I grew up in a small town in the South, you know, in the 70s that had yet to be touched by the cultural revolution of the 60s and 70s. I grew up thinking, you know, the right wing was basically, you know, people like Jerry Falwell. And, you know, I came from the same town that Jerry Falwell was headquartered in. My family actually has an interesting history with his, but I grew up with that. You know, I grew up with around people that were into, you know, what might be called the know-nothing right. And I came to the conclusion as a young person that, well, if you wanted to be smart, you had to be against the right. So you had to be on the left. So I more or less became a leftist by default. And I, you know, would participate in all the different, you know, left-wing and, you know, counterculture youth activities that were around back in those days. You know, I was a big fan of bands like the Dead Kennedys and that kind of stuff. And I was also, a big fan of guys like Noam Chomsky. I used to belong to the Industrial Workers of the World. But when I first started encountering political correctness, you know, there wasn't really a term for it at the time. You know, it wasn't PC wasn't a mainstream concept like it is now. It was sort of a subculture, and I really had never encountered anything like that before, and I was like, wow, some of the stuff is just absolutely out to lunch. What's some of the craziest stuff you've seen in the left-wing subculture?
The zoophiles, the people that have sex with animals and that want to be accepted for that. That's, you know, even if I wasn't an animal rights activist, that's ridiculous. Come on. Maybe if everybody hates you and thinks you're disgusting, maybe there's a reason for that. You really want to be taken seriously, but you want to have sex with sheep. Come on. There's got to be a limit to, I think, I was saying before, do what you want to do, okay, as long as it's not harming others. Something like that, you are harming others, you're harming these animals. But do what you want to do, but you can't expect everybody to accept it. You know, you can't, you want to weigh 500 pounds and wear a bikini, you can do that. That's fine with me, but don't expect you can't expect no one's going to laugh at you. I mean, that's just human nature. Some things are weird, and we're going to laugh at them. And I think that's okay. I think it's okay for you to do it. You know, the transsexuals, I got in an argument dealing with transsexuals. The guy said, well, they shouldn't be treated any differently. I said, well, do you want to sleep with one? And he said, well, yes. I think that, if you discriminate against them, they should be looked at as, if they're women, they should be treated like women. So now heterosexual men, if they don't want to sleep with transsexuals, they're homophobic? And he said, yes. Stuff like that is ridiculous. That's going overboard. And we did have like a zoophile group at Occupy Wall Street. Luckily, they weren't having sex with animals there, or else I'd have, you know, big problem with that. But, wanting people to accept the most outrageous behaviors and then calling them racist or prejudice or bigots if they don't, I think that's unfair. There's just some things that are unacceptable. I don't know if you agree or not, but...
Well, I think most people still would agree that having sex with animals is not a good idea.
They're trying to change that, though. There's some that are trying to change that.
You've also mentioned your encounters with some of these male feminists who are definitely some interesting characters. I've encountered those along the way on the left. Tell us a little bit about those.
Oh, the male feminists?
Yes.
Okay, I have an example of one that stands out to me more than any of them. He was a very whiny, obnoxious little man who I had an encounter with him because I was actually living in I was living in Brooklyn at the time, and there was this activist commune there called Surreal Estate, and he was living in the basement there. And he was involved with a lot of the same causes I was, as well as animal rights. One of a guy I knew who went to prison for years for liberating minks on a fur farm, his ex-girlfriend was insane, and she was accusing him of all kinds of things, rape and everything else. He was able to produce tons of emails showing that she was crazy, saying that, I love you, come back to me. If you don't come back to me, I'll ruin your life. So she was obviously lying. But this man took her side and went so far to destroy one of the tried and true activists in the community. This is someone that doesn't stand outside with a sign and yell at people. This is someone that went to prison for helping animals to liberate them. He went in front of the animal rights convention, handed out flyers to everybody with the man's picture on it, saying that he was a rapist, saying that he mistreated women, that he was a chauvinist, that all the women in the convention needed to be careful, beware, you know, because I'm sure he would just snatch them out of the audience and rape them. You know, it was ridiculous. But I confronted him afterwards. I said, you know, he didn't rape her. This was consensual. There are emails that show this. And he said, well, he did rape her because he's initiated sex before with her. And I said, what? And he explained to me that any sex act between a man and a woman is rape unless the woman initiates it, because there is an imbalance of power between men and women. Wow. I can't even believe that, but that's what he said. And I think some of the male feminists are worse than the females. You know, there's a lot fewer of them, I think as a man, how could you say something like that? You're never going to want to initiate sex with a woman. And if you do, you're going to have to call yourself a rapist. So that was my experience with the male feminists in the group.
Well, in all the years that I've encountered all of these crazy elements on the far left, going back about 25 years or so, the thing that I've always been concerned about is, on one hand, it's easy to laugh at these people and talk about what freaks they are, and they obviously are. It is true that a lot of these really bizarre, freakish elements that we find on the far left, the zoophile rights people, the male feminists or female feminists who think that any sexual relationships between males and females that are initiated by a male constitute rape. The people who want to normalize and legitimize child molestation. This kind of stuff seems to be gaining in popularity, and that's without even getting into other aspects of left-wing extremism, of political correctness that are even more mainstream. For example, the obsession with eliminating any perceived system of privilege based on race or gender or sexual orientation. What I've always been concerned about is the more powerful this kind of thinking becomes, what kind of society would they create in the process? I mean, are we going to have some sort of reverse caste system where, everyone's rights are based on their group identity, and then the group's rights are based on how oppressed the group is, and this pantheon of the oppressed? That was a term coined by Justin Raimondo of antiwar.com. He said the left has this pantheon of the oppressed, and, they have all these mascot groups that they hold up as deities that, represent the suffering just. I know I referred you to my article, The New Totalitarianism. For the listeners, I wrote an article that's still available on the LouRockwell.com website. It's called The New Totalitarianism, where I outline some of the origins of political correctness as I've been able to trace it and discuss some of its theoretical implications. But where do you see all of this going in the future?
I think it's terrifying. You can't criticize anyone anymore for fear of being racist or sexist. These special interest groups get all these privileges, and I see it as a nation of degenerates, of just really pathetic, pitiful people. I see it as a nation of degenerates, a really fractured group of broken people that basically need their diapers changed for them because they want these special privileges. I see no one holding on to any type of good values. I don't see any kind of progression of humanity. I see it falling apart. If we just continue giving special privileges to the most desperate and pitiful people in society, no one's allowed to say anything or be critical of them. So how will anything change? We can't criticize ghetto culture, so how will it ever change? Even black people cannot criticize their own culture. Bill Cosby was called a racist for saying that, black men should be better family men, that they need to be more responsible. He's criticized. He can't even say anything. So how does anything improve? How do people elevate themselves morally, socially, economically, if none of us can criticize? If we're so politically correct and so afraid, and if all these groups keep getting special privileges, where does that leave the rest of us who are sane, who do want to do the right thing, who aren't out fucking sheep or shooting people up or selling crack? Where does that leave the rest of us?
Well,
I feel like we're the ones who are going to get pushed into bad situations.
One thing that I've noticed about the left in its present form, and I think that the left in many ways is today a much different movement from the historic left. The historic left was more about worker power or things of that nature.
Right.
But the left that's really come out of the Cultural Revolutions of the 60s and 70s, particularly in its more contemporary form, I think is more about this kind of therapeutic culture that has this kind of really radical victimological outlook, where it's almost like you you achieve self-legitimation by proclaiming yourself to be oppressed. I know there was a journalist that used to do a lot of writing back in the 1980s. He's deceased now, but he was a columnist for the, I believe, for the Washington Post. He was sort of a neocon type. His name was Richard Greiner, but he once said that if all of the victimological claims of the PC left were to be taken seriously, then something like, he said, oppressed minorities would make up something like 372% of the population. Because they keep adding, you know, the left keeps expanding the definition of oppression in such a way that it really in a way that insults people that are genuinely oppressed by defining oppression in ever more dubious ways. But I've noticed in my own experiences with the left, the really PC, I mean, the left does a lot of different things. There's a lot of different strands to the left, but the hardcore politically correct ideologues and the people from the most intense victimological groups tend to have this outlook that political activism is there to provide them with some sort of group therapy. I've seen that over and over again among these kinds of left-wing activist groups. It's, you know, you're there to feel good about yourself because you're making a statement. You know, it's not that you're there to make a contribution to some cause that you believe in. You're there to feel good about yourself because you're making a statement. And meanwhile, you know, whatever kind of activism you're doing, it's about, you know, providing you with a venue to, you know, discuss all of your personal neurosis and hang-ups and psychological problems and, you know, mental illnesses and, you know, family issues. You know, and what's interesting to me is I've encountered this kind of thinking even among people that I otherwise respect. I remember having a conversation with a man whose work in certain fields I think is excellent work. He's a left-wing writer, commentator, scholar, and even he was criticizing some of my views because he said that a lot of my own activism, my own politics, involved getting too close to what he calls cultural authoritarians. You know, and I responded, well, you know, it's not exactly cut and dried as to who the cultural authoritarians are. You know, are do-gooders who want to smoke, say you can't smoke in a bar, are they cultural authoritarians? You know, but what he meant by that was he was talking about how he had a religious upbringing that was, you know, very conservative and, in his view, oppressive, and he feels like he was psychologically damaged by his Christian upbringing and that kind of thing. And, you know, the point that I raised was, well, yeah, but that's not a political issue. I mean, if you, you know, don't like the religion that you grew up with, then as an adult you have the option of finding another one or none at all. You know, that was the case with me. I didn't like the religion that I grew up with. You know, when I became an adult, I chose to not adopt or practice any religion. You know, some people don't feel that way. You know, my brother grew up in the same environment I did. He's continued within that same religious tradition, you know, and that's his choice. And that's what I see the left as being about. I mean, like you were saying about the feminists, they're not about making, upholding the right of anyone to make choices, you know, unless it's to have, you know, have sex in the public park or, you know, have late-term abortions. It's all about preempting other people's choices and ruling other people's lives according to some kind of twisted, you know, ideology that they have about how everything ought to be and what they're, you know, and I also see a great deal of narcissism in these sectors where they really seem to have this view that the whole world has got to revolve around their problem. You know, no one likes them because they had a sex change operation or because they're fat or they've got some, endocrine problem where they have an excess of body hair. Or, you know, it's just personal neurosis has become the basis of politics. Now, one last thing I wanted to discuss with you, we're almost out of time, but I know that animal welfare and ecology are something that you obviously care very passionately about. What would you suggest someone do? What kind of action should someone take if they really wanted to promote animal welfare or really help the ecology?
You could do several things. You can make a personal statement And by going vegan, I'm not going to lie, it does not make a dent in our food system by an individual going vegan. Our 50% of edible food ends up in the garbage anyway, and everything is government subsidized. Meat, dairy, and eggs is government subsidized. So I'm not going to lie and say you're going to save thousands of animals by going vegan, but it is a statement, a personal statement that you're making that you reject oppression of these animals. So you could do that. You can do direct rescue of animals if you want to get involved. One of the best ways you can save an animal is go to your local shelter and adopt one. You can, now, with protesting, there are ways to do it that are effective. You're not going to end up shutting down McDonald's by a few protests, but you might be able to say, like, a fur store in your area. If it's a small fur store, you could do a targeted campaign against it. I don't mean yelling with a bullhorn and being obnoxious. But, you know, standing outside with some pictures of what goes on in these fur farms, maybe, you know, bring out a video and show some videos of what happens in the fur farms, hand out literature, and, you know, hold a boycott, and you can actually get small stores shut down. We've gotten puppy mill sellers, pet stores that sell puppy mill dogs shut down before by doing that. And also, if you really want to be a radical, there's always going underground and liberating animals that way. But I don't do that. I'm above ground. I wish I had the courage to do that. But many activists have lost their lives and their freedom for doing that. And it's amazing. It's probably the best way to save animals. But you have to understand the consequences if you're going to go that route. And as far as, you know, the environment, you know, get involved with what's going on in your community. A lot of times you can't change. It's very hard to change global stuff. But something like hydraulic water fracking, it's possible that you could put bans on that by getting involved with other activists in your community. So, spreading awareness. You know, I've been doing this for so long that right now all I do is direct rescue of animals. I stand outside in the middle of the street with some cages full of animals, try to get them homes and pass out vegan literature. I'm not trying to say I'm enacting any type of revolutionary change at this point in my life, but I am helping some animals, so I feel good about that. That's where I'm at right now.
Okay, well, on that note, we are unfortunately out of time. I could definitely keep this conversation going, but I can't do that. Thank you very much, Tia. You've been a very interesting guest, and thank you for coming on the program. I really do hope you'll come back and join us again at some point.
I'd love to. Thank you so much, Keith.
Thank you, and thank you to our listeners for tuning in. Thanks to Greg and Matt and Mike at Countercurrents for putting the new network together and inviting me to appear on the network. Until next time.